Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So today I have in the studio a Rolling Stone legend, Anthony DeCurtis, who's been writing for the magazine for 35 years, and he has a new book out called Lou Reed, A Life. Well, it's going to be out. It's going to be out October
10th.
October 10th, and it's a pretty definitive, exquisitely researched biography of Lou Reed, and it obviously represents a very intense amount of work, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about the life and music of Lou Reed with Mr. Anthony DeCurtis. I thought we might start with a clip of you talking to Lou himself, someone in an occasion that happened fairly often. You guys knew each other.
Yeah.
He was comfortable with you. And the clip I'm going to play is from a very different kind of interview you did with him at the University of Pennsylvania, where you teach.
Exactly.
And you got Lou Reed to come up to the University of Pennsylvania and sit with a class and allow you to interview him in front of them. And you actually talk about this in the preface of your book. Explain a little bit about how that happened. And
well, it was every year we have a kind donor who has underwritten the ability to bring down a singer-songwriter once a year. But getting Lou down was really a trick. And it was kind of like the one time Lou Reed played Lou Reed with me, and because this thing was like a year in the planning. And, in a way that I'm sure you'll recognize is never a good sign, his manager called me about 2 days before it was supposed to happen and said, maybe you should talk to Lou. And I thought that was your job, but... as it turns out, Lou was beginning to have second thoughts, and I'll come down and do the interview, but I don't want to do the other stuff. But all of the stuff, it was, the whole event, they all went together. And, we had a pretty tense exchange about it. But in fact, he showed up and had a good time. But it was, like so many things with Lou, like every strategy worked. If he goes out and is a nice guy, that works. But if he doesn't come and it's like, Lou, is he going to come out? He's here. They said he's here, but he's not. And then finally, when we walked out, I could feel, like, even though it was a small room, it's like 50 or 60 people, it was, you could feel the energy in the room. It was like, oh, wow, like, that's Lou Reed. Like, he finally came out. He's doing it.
And before we play this clip of you talking with Lou Reed, I want to talk about your relationship with him on a broader sense, because you experienced good Lou, but you quickly in your research talked to a lot of people who experienced a lot of other sides
sure.
of Lou.
Well, look, we've all heard the stories. There was no mystery there. There was, I never really bought the thing. There were people who would say, because Lou was mean to journalists, all the time. And, look, some of those people were jerks, and some of them were, like, really nice, smart people who very much enjoyed Lou Reed and believed deeply in his importance. One of the things, in a funny way, that was one of the issues that I wanted to kind of get after, not his attitude towards journalists, but his attitude towards journalists as a symptom of something else. Because... it's one thing if, some pop star doesn't like journalists. That's great. Like, I've got 50 million fans. They love me. Some dweeb writing in some magazine doesn't. Who cares? But Lou Reed owed his career to journalists. It was journalists, and musicians, but primarily journalists who kept the Velvet Underground in people's minds. There was an element of, it wasn't the general population. And so what was it that accounted for this difficulty that he had with journalists? And I really feel it was like, I felt like with him there was always a doubleness. And I think the fact that I think he was aware that he did owe journalists something. And I think that played out, with various musicians that he worked with who would make contributions, producers he worked with who would make contributions. Someone like Andy Warhol, for example. I think Lou got what he needed from Warhol and then I think began to resent Warhol. That story all got smoothed over, I think, after Andy died. But, that doubleness where, you start out kind of collaborating and appreciating with some appreciating someone, and then it somehow turns. I think that was a really kind of key aspect of his personality.
So let's hear Anthony DeCurtis and Lou Reed talking. How long ago was this?
This would have been, I think, it might have been 2012, you know, the year before he died. It might have been 2011, 2012.
So let's hear a very reflective and friendly Lou Reed talking with Anthony DeCurtis.
Talk about, you know, the first time you heard rock and roll, you know, what it meant to you and how it gripped you. I mean, this is a part of you that, you know, has stayed so true through all of the transformations, even as you've done other things than rock and roll. The kind of the sound of it and the chords and your guitar playing is so much a part of what that is and what
bar bands since age 14. Right, so, across the street from the high school, you know, I was in these bands and we would play seriously bad places. It's like, you know, after hours kind of things. And I had this amazing luck because things would happen. And just as it was coming at me, something would stop it. Somebody would grab somebody or somebody, whatever, and it would just stop right here. And if it hadn't, I wouldn't even be here, you know, but it would just stop, whatever it was, the problem. Like, guys, you know, you're fucking playing, and I got money in the jukebox, you cocksucker. Yes, sir. You know, it's, okay, well, yeah, okay. You know, and they're getting ready to beat you to death over that. And something would stop that from happening. You know, so I was listening to it from the radio. That's when the radio meant something.
So were the first things like kind of doo-wop? Was it, and, you know, this kind doo-wop, of very beautiful and
doo-wop
stuff?
Soul, the sound of the hound out of Buffalo. Did you ever hear him?
I never heard him, but I know what that is.
He was wonderful. Jocko, up, 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 big bed, rocket higher, higher, higher. Yes, I love this shit. Serious, you know, Alan Freed. When he hit New York on Winds Radio. Later on, we had a record out while I was in high school, and Alan Freed was supposed to play it, and he was sick that day, and they had Paul Sherman sitting in for Alan Freed, and they played it once. That was it.
Was it exciting to hear it on the radio?
Wow. Are you kidding? On Alan Freed, even if it was the sub? I was 14. We had a record out. I mean, I didn't sing it. I wrote it, but I hadn't moved up front yet. I was way in the back.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. You know, one of the, I think it's easy to understand the kind of aspirations of somebody to become a musician or become in a band. And, you know, kids can look at that and see it and be excited by it. What about the songwriting? Where did that come from? The idea of writing songs, like, you know, I mean, it takes a while for people even to know that, you know, songs just don't happen. You know, somebody sits there and does it. You know, when did that idea, you know,
from playing songs wrong? Or forgetting the lyric. So you'd make up your own. You say, I see how this works. It just is. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So, and, you know, when I was in school getting the degree in English, I was, you know, like, that was okay, but I was very aware of that other side over there. That I was way more interested in that than that, to say the least, because I liked rock. And I've never not liked rock. It's like something hit me and never let me go. And I wrote songs about it.
A Sweet Jane, for one.
Well, rock and roll.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't kidding. It's like, can you imagine if we didn't have black people? No soul music. No rock. It's unthinkable. You know, it's such a horrifying thought, and there's no black people here. You know, it's like, wow. Just think about it. We'd still be doing madrigals.
So that was Lou Reed talking to Anthony DeCurtis, and Anthony has a book coming out, Lou Reed A Life, on October 10th. Anthony, tell me about Lou's childhood and especially what you sort of learned about it in the process of your reporting and research that you didn't know and the world might not have known until you were got in there.
Well, one of the things, you know, almost like, you know, Franz Kafka wrote this book called Letter to His Father, in which he describes his father as this kind of monstrous figure. And Lou always kind of described his own father as this monstrous figure. I mean, he was an accountant, had his own firm, lived out in on Long Island, in Freeport, Long Island, although Lou was born in Brooklyn. And he would describe his father in these, you know, really grim terms as this kind of, you know, very dominant figure. And and wrote a song called Kill Your Sons, where, you know, well, the title kind of speaks for itself. And I remember when I was interviewing his first wife, his name is Betty Kronstadt, and it was one of the early interviews I did. I mean, I was happy to find her. She hadn't really done much stuff. And I went to Chicago to interview her, and we, you know, talked for, you know, a couple of days. And one of the things, you know, she was talking about Lou being cheap, which was a little leitmotif of many interviews, actually. And she was saying, you know, we lived in small apartments, and you know, no matter how much money Lou was making, and you know, he never wanted to ask his parents for money. And I just immediately said, well, I mean, would his father have given him money? And she said, of course his father would have given him money, like anything for Lou. And this sense of who this guy was, you know, it's almost like Lou invented him in order to be able to rebel against that figure. Now, there were issues there. I mean, as a kid, as a very young kid, certainly as a teenager, you know, Lou was using drugs. You know, back in the early 60s, he was, you know, kind of, you know, going to gay bars and things like this, which, you know, was well before the days of gay liberation. And, you know, his extremely middle class Jewish suburban parents, and particularly his father, you know, it was unsettling for them. I mean, they weren't brutal,
homophobes. Yeah,
homophobes. It just was, you know, it was like your kid wanted to be a Martian or something. It just made no sense to them. And the treatment that was recommended for this was shock treatment. Now, that at the time was not uncharacteristic. It was pretty typical. But it made a big impression on Lou. It was very traumatic. And he wrote about it. He spoke about it. And he never forgave his parents for it. His mother felt very guilty about it. I don't think his father particularly did. I mean, I think his father felt, you know, I did what I felt that I could do, you know, and I think tried to make it up with him in many ways. But in a lot of ways, his father, his name was Sid, was as, well, you know, his son got all of his strong will and his stubbornness from somewhere. And the two of them, I think, clashed in that regard. There was an element, I think, you know, Sid wanted a kid who would take over the accounting business. I think that would have been his dream.
He got the wrong kid.
Yeah, and the wrong, you know, Lou just showed up. But I mean, it was really interesting. I talked to this friend of his one time who just said, you know, I mean, it was a very interesting turn of phrase he used. He goes, you know, with Lou, his parents didn't turn out the way he wanted them to be. Mm. You know, and I think that was, you know, it was just, so he invented sort of the parents that he needed in order for him to become Lou Reed.
One of your sources said that he felt like Lou, even deep into his life, was so preoccupied with just shocking his parents.
Absolutely.
It's incredibly juvenile. And I mean, obviously, it produced amazing some of the most amazing rock and roll ever and some great art. But it's incredible that he was still driven by that. It's insane.
Brian, yeah. The last interview he ever did, which was a kind of promotional interview, as it happens, for some headphones. He was a real gearhead and loved any kind of new equipment. And after he'd had his liver transplant, he did an interview, and this very polite and sweet young French woman was interviewing him. This is the kind of person Lou would typically have no use for, but I think at that point in his life, he was willing, to deal with her. And she was just, she knew that Lou Reed was an important rock star, and she was mostly asking him about the headphones. But, she wanted to ask some questions about how he got interested in music. And she said, Lou, did you get interested in rock and roll? Did your father give you a guitar? And Lou Reed just said, my father didn't give me shit.
Mm.
Just like that. And I just felt like, this is like at the very end. And at Lou's memorial service at the Apollo, the painter Julian Schnabel told a story about that Lou told him. They were, he was holding Lou at the swimming pool at Lou and Laurie's house out in the Hamptons. And Lou told him a story about going to the beach with his father and his father slapping him. Now, I ran that story by a bunch of people who said to me, like, look, I wasn't there, but the idea of Sid slapping Lou is inconceivable. Mm. But Lou held on to that idea and sort of went to the grave with it.
So Lou started really becoming Lou Reed as early as high school. He was somehow obtaining weed in a time when that was not very easy for a Long Island teenager to do.
Certainly not. Yeah.
In fact, his friends still don't know where he was getting it.
That's right.
And he was also, slipping out to gay bars.
Yep.
and writing stories that kind of drew on sort of like gay fantasies, while at the same time many of his friends felt that he was completely heterosexual. So that even that dichotomy was there from the beginning.
I think, some version of that ran through his whole life. I think that unpacking Lou's sexual life, on one level, who cares? On the other level, he wrote about it, and that whole world, a kind of world of S&M sex and gay sex and all of that is part of his work. So I felt like it was fair game, but it was difficult to untangle where exactly he was, because you talked to some of his high school friends and they were like, Lou was playing tennis and
riding horses.
Completely. Yeah. Having part-time jobs and all this other stuff that kids in high school do. But, he had this other life where, at night he was going out to, a pretty well-known, gay bar out on the island and getting weed kind of exploring also like literature. At that time, I was alive back then. I was, a little bit younger than Lou. But, I sort of remember all of this, these magazines that would come out, like Evergreen, that were sort of avant-garde. And, in a certain way, Hugh Hefner just recently died, and he obviously broke certain, sexual codes. But, the avant-garde did that too, exploring all of this kind of underworld sex. And, and Lou read all that stuff. He was reading books like City of Night and things like that when he was really young. And, that became part of his world. I think it was his, his journey out of suburbia. But, it was sort of contained within suburbia and also coexisted with suburbia. There was a lot about suburbia that Lou liked. Lou trashed Long Island all the time. Where did he die? Long Island, The Hamptons are still part of that. And being by the water is still part of that. All the stuff that he grew up with, was part of the world that, he also reconstructed for himself. So there was always, again, I return to this idea of this kind of doubleness about him, the bisexuality, these kind of emotions that would shift. It was complicated to find through lines through all that.
So Lou went off to Syracuse University.
Right.
And he was already a musician. He had some success in high school as a musician.
Right.
And, but he also wanted to be a writer, and he also wanted to take a lot of drugs and sleep with a number of women. So this all kind of came together for him in his college years.
That's true. All of that is correct. Yeah, there was a sense in which, Lou's aspirations, I mean, some of which overlapped. I mean, I think, as he would repeatedly say later, at Syracuse, one of the people he studied with was the poet Delmore Schwartz, and that made a huge impression on him. I think partly because Delmore Schwartz is a great writer, but also because I think it gave him a sense of what can happen in a larger world. Like suddenly, I'm talking to someone that T.S. Eliot said was one of the best writers he had ever read. And I think that was a glimpse of what was possible. And, so all of the bands that he was in, and, like a lot of musicians starting out, there was this band and a version of that band. He played, by himself sometimes. And he was kind of a folky starting out. I mean, like some of his girlfriends from back then would tell me, Lou would sit there and strum songs to them, an unlikely picture, but nonetheless. But I think that, he wanted finally to fuse those things, to fuse the kind of high literary world that he encountered with Delmore Schwartz with this kind of, this great gritty rock and roll that he loved, which is finally, I think, what he managed to do. And so, he was in bar bands, essentially. I mean, and he was trying to write his own songs and doing it now and then. But, they would do a bunch of covers
They played at fraternities.
Exactly. Yeah. Some gigs, they'd get paid a lot of money. Some gigs, not so much. And, he was running around and also dealing drugs. I mean, he nearly got thrown out of Syracuse for that. Managed to stay, graduated with honors in English. And then came back to New York.
And he comes back to New York and he gets sort of the low rent equivalent of a Brill Building gig, I guess is how I describe it.
That's exactly right. He got a job at a place called Pickwick Records, which is in Long Island City, just across the East River in Queens. And they would do these knockoffs. I don't even think anything remotely like this exists anymore, but like back when I was a kid, you would go to a store, you would go to the 5 and 10, which is where you would go mostly to buy records. And there would be like, oh, wow, like that group kind of looks like the Beatles, but it's not the Beatles. It's the Beatles with their name, maybe with two E's rather than B-E-A-T. And, whatever was happening, if it was, surf music, they would go to someone like Lou Reed and say, write a bunch of surf songs. And he would do it. They'd put a band together, in the studio. They'd release it as the Beach Nuts. And it would be in a store. And, people would think the Beach Nuts were real. And so finally, though, there was this one great moment where, based on something he'd read in the newspapers, that ostrich feathers were going to be a fashion trend, Lou wrote a song called Do the Ostrich, which, by the way, if anybody can, online you can hear it, has a monstrous riff. And but it's, like a stupid dance song. It's like Do the Ostrich. But it kind of got a thing. People invited them to play these teen TV shows, and then they put a band together.
I think we can actually hear Lou Reed's bizarre 60s song, The Ostrich, right now.
Stole that bass line so straight out of him, and then he kissed me.
Incredible.
It's hilarious.
But it's actually really cool, though.
Yeah. No, it's great.
But this actually led to the formation of the Velvet Underground.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Because strangely, people were picking up on that song. And, there used to be all these little teen shows that were on TV. And, TV was sort of just starting around then. This is sort of early 60s. And so they needed a band to go play the song because there was no real band. And so they went around and, somebody ran into John Cale, who, was an avant-garde musician. And, but he had long hair. you know, which back then would have meant, you know, he might be a musician, you know. And he also, you know, he had a Welsh accent, which, you know, in those days you could mistake for an English accent. So I just walked up to him and said, you know, we're doing this thing. The guy met him at a party and said, so suddenly John Cale's in the band. They picked up these two other musicians, essentially, that Cale knew, who were also like sculptors and things like that. And they became the Primitives. And they went out and did some shows. But, I mean, the interesting thing about that was Reed and Cale getting together. You know, and there you have like one of the great matchups of rock history, really. You know, this guy who loved rock and roll and had these high literary aspirations, and this other guy who also liked rock and roll, but also, you know, had this avant-garde music kind of idea, and they got together and they just kind of like got the best out of all of that. You know, later, obviously, Sterling Morrison and Maureen Tucker came into the picture, but, you know, that was it. The Primitives were kind of the germ of what became the Velvet Underground.
And, you know, the story of the Velvet Underground has been fairly well gone over, but you have some new bits in your book, to be sure. What surprised you most that you didn't know about Lou's part in the Velvet Underground as you did your reporting?
Well, you know, there's a number of interesting aspects to it. The thing that struck me most about it, and maybe it was only my own naivete that didn't make me recognize this earlier, was just how savvy Lou was being the whole time. You know, because when Andy Warhol came along and, you know, wanted to sort of manage, quote unquote, the band, and you know, essentially that put them on a media platform. I mean, Andy Warhol, even when I was a kid here in New York City, was in the newspapers every day. You know, for, you know, people got a kick out of it. This is the guy with the Campbell's soup cans,
right,
and the Coca-Cola bottles and all this. But he still was a name. And, you know, just your association with him, you know, elevated you out of, you know, the other 50 million bands playing around New York City. But Lou, I think, was, you know, as much as he valued Andy, and I think he understood what Andy was doing and learned a tremendous amount from him, was always looking beyond him. I think that there was a sense in which the Velvet Underground always, in Lou's mind, was going to be Lou's band. And, you know, so his collaboration with John Cale, you know, eventually gets sacrificed. Andy Warhol eventually gets sacrificed. You know, there was a kind of singularity of will on the part of him, even as a young guy, that really made an impression on me as I did all this research and, you know, talked to, you know, various people who were around. It became clear, like, that kind of vision that it takes to become, you know, Lou Reed, you know, and there is, you know, there are always, I mean, there's some fallout from that, you know. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, Cale leaving the Velvet Underground was a great loss.
Mm. But could they have made that more accessible music without him?
No.
Yeah, so it's a loss and possibly a gain. You
right,
know, it's
exactly.
Fascinating
right.
thing. And they essentially became a different band at that point. Yeah,
exactly.
And this has always been a famous story and one that always boggled my mind. But the fact that when Lou left the Velvet Underground, he went back to live with his parents on Long Island and worked as a typist.
One story that I heard that I was not able to confirm was that the night he quit the Velvet Underground, they were doing, they had a standing gig like all summer. Nobody really even knew why. They didn't have a new record out at the time or anything. But at Max's, Kansas City, and they were playing there, you know, 3, 4, 5 nights a week. And one night, Lou just kind of told them, you know, by the way, I'm quitting the band. Somebody told me that his parents were waiting outside the club when after the gig and to drive him back to Long Island. I was not able to confirm that, but that is perfectly possible. You know, that Sid Reed, you know, the great villain of Lou's life, would have like sat in a car outside this club waiting for his son to finish his show in order to drive him home. I don't know absolutely that's true. It could very well have happened.
You know, I talked with Lizzie Goodman, who wrote a book about 2000s rock in New York, and one of the things we talked about was, you know, that the Strokes were playing rock star and emulating the ones who got heavy into drugs, were in some sense, you know, emulating some idea of like Lou Reed or
Keith
Richards. But here's the crazy thing, as your book makes clear, in some ways Lou Reed was emulating some abstract idea of Lou Reed or some idea of... And at points it feels like, and I'd love you to address this, he wasn't sure whether he was playing a role of being someone who was fascinated with decadence and diving into the underworld and nearly dying, and what was going on there between the role and the real guy, and did he have any grasp or understanding, especially in his, you know, pre-sober days?
I think that grasp came and went. That understanding came and went. That is to say, I don't mean like at a... I mean, I think he moved in and out of it. And I think, like, you know, look, the mask that sticks to you is like one of the oldest tropes of, you know, literature.
Sure.
And I think, you know, part of that, you know, Lou would talk about, you know, the Lou Reed persona as if he were talking about somebody else. And all of those things, you know, to the degree to which, yeah, there are people would say, you know, like, oh, you know, I mean, all this gay stuff that he did, that was just to shock people. That was just to piss people off, you know, and upset. Certainly his father, like Lou would swish around the house, you know, and he knew that would drive his father crazy. Now, he also had sex with guys, you know, I mean, how far do you go, you know, in order to do this? And that element of, you know, where that line is, you know, because there was a deeply conventional aspect to him. There was a part of him that was very much a product of his environment, you know. And, you know, I remember one time interviewing him, and he said, it was at the 92nd Street Y here in New York, as a matter of fact. Somebody asked him a question about, you know, like sexual confusion and the blurring of these lines. And he just said, when you're straight and sober, there's no confusion. And another line.
But that's not true for most people.
It's not true, but I mean, I think in his mind, well, look, I mean, here's something else he said. I mean, this, you know, somebody told me this, you know, kind of did not want it attributed to him, but it was a friend of his, you know, early on when he was writing those stories that you were talking about. And the guy said, you know, this is much later, he was married to Sylvia, you know, his second wife. And, you know, this guy said, oh, you know, I have all these manuscripts, you know, that you had given me, you know, very early on. And, you know, I'd be happy to give them back to you. And Lou just said, I don't want anything to do with that. And I think that, like, that was part of who he was.
Yeah, I found that disturbing, honestly. You know, it's because he was talking about him, you know, he was reacting to some aspect of himself.
Absolutely.
And you know, I mean, listen, he was Jewish and he also used slurs against Jews.
Absolutely.
He was a confused guy in some ways.
You know, look, I mean, that was the way it played out. I mean, I think that there was, you know, on the other hand, by the end of his life, he was, you know, I mean, you know, going to Israel with Laurie Anderson and all this other stuff.
And as far as the you know, the use of anti-gay slur, at the same time, just a few, you know, just a little bit later in your book, he got mad at John Mellencamp for having Guns N' Roses play Farm Aid after the song One in a Million, which had, well, actually there's so many groups slurred in that song, but among them, I think the reference to AIDS was really what got under his skin. So there was a lot of self-loathing that was expressed as outward loathing.
It was self-loathing, and as long as it came from him loathing himself, he was okay with it. If it came from you loathing him, that was a problem. I think, you know, I mean, he would say that all the time about, like, John Cale and Nico. He goes, you know, look, it's fine for me. I fought with those people all the time, but, like, if you criticize them to me, that's a problem. And I think, you know, a lot of this was driven internally. And by the way, you know, we started out talking about this hostility towards journalists. I think Lou was embarrassed by a lot of interviews that he gave where he said
the early ones, yeah,
crazy stuff about, you know, what his sex life was like and all of these things, you know, and the anti-Semitic slurs and all of that stuff that was in there. And I think he was really embarrassed. And whenever, like, a journalist as much as said, oh, you know, you once said, he would snap.
Yeah.
And I think that's about that. And that's about hating something that he himself did, that to embarrass himself.
So he had a relationship with I guess, you know, the lines were a little blurrier then, but I think it would be accurate to say a trans woman named Rachel.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things your book made me realize is Lester Bang's infamous, you know, he had a bunch of infamous interviews with Lou, and I know you're not a big fan of Lester, which is, I think, an undercurrent of this book.
Slightly.
But it's there. Yeah. But, you know, Lester made some comments about Rachel that, with, you know, full perspective now, were understandably unforgivable to Lou. He was, for all Lester himself prided himself on transgression, and I'm a bigger fan of his writing than you are, but I understand your objections to him. He couldn't even understand a trans person. He was, you know, and he I won't even repeat how he, you know, how he described her, but meanwhile, by the way, Lou himself would what we now call misgender her. He people were still grappling this, but
completely.
But one of the things you did was really humanize and explain this relationship, which was a very real relationship. He lived with Rachel. Yep. They appeared to have been lovers. She was also, though, his assistant.
Yep.
And she kept him kind of safe, and he kept her safe. But then, like with a lot of things, their relationship completely disappeared, and he basically never spoke of her again.
Yeah, I mean, what exactly happened with him and Rachel is really unclear. You know, Rachel led, her birth name was Richard Humphreys. You know, sort of a double life, I mean, which is something Lou certainly recognized, you know, of a kind of, you know, kind of transgender person, you know, on the street scene, you know, yeah. And knew how to use a knife, was rumored to have killed somebody in prison. And there was a kind of incredible sweetness, and it was amazing. There was an amazing Rorschach quality about talking to all of the people who knew Rachel. Some of them would describe her as, you know, like the most, she would look like the most beautiful woman I ever saw. I mean, Lou talked to this one girlfriend of his, you know, who was asking about Rachel, and he just said, look, she's more beautiful than any fucking woman. You know?
One of the things that's very clear reading your book is, you know, how much music Lou produced.
Yeah, very
we were
true.
Saying that I was saying in the break that he probably made a few more albums than he should have.
Yeah, than he needed to, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, actually, should have is probably silly because we're grateful to have all of it, especially now that he's gone. But which corners of his catalog, maybe especially in the later era, jumped out as things that are little neglected, underrated, etc.?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there were a bunch of songs, certainly, like a song like Mistrial, you know, which I, you know, noted when it came out, didn't mean a lot to me, you know, sounds a lot better now. And the sort of later Lou Reed, you know, the album Ecstasy, of course, you know, had a tremendous power. And, you know, when I first heard his collaboration with Metallica on Lulu, I just kind of rolled my eyes and thought, whatever. But there are some incredibly beautiful and powerful and affecting things on that record as well. David Bowie told Laurie Anderson that he thought that record would be recognized, you know, eventually. Now, that's something David Bowie would say and say to Laurie Anderson, and she would believe it. But I do actually think it's true.
There are a couple moments where Lou seemed to get a sense of his influence and be able to appreciate it. One was in Czechoslovakia with Václav Havel, and Havel just implored him to please play at this club, and Lou was being very difficult.
Extremely.
And then he agrees to do it, and as it happens, there's basically like a brilliant Velvet Underground cover band there. And after he plays his own set, he gets on stage with them and plays Velvet Underground songs for this audience of, I mean, explain who was in the audience and what this meant.
Well, it was incredible. You know, obviously Havel was, you know, first of all, a writer of world renown and also an activist in Czechoslovakia. You know, when it was really under the boot of Russia, you know, the I mean, behind the Iron Curtain doesn't begin to describe it. You know, and the, you know, he went to jail, all of his, you know, sort of friends went to jail. And but the Velvet Underground were like big inspirations for them. And, you know, this was really, I mean, people throw around all the time, you know, the subversive power of music, you know, blah, blah, blah. This really was it. You know, these guys, you know, found in Lou and the Velvets a kind of vision of freedom. And, you know, for Lou to go there and play these songs to these people who finally had overthrown, you know, the Soviet regime that had ruled their country for so long was an incredible moment. I mean, Lou had to be dragged kicking and screaming there. But in fact, you know, it was perhaps really the greatest honor of his career.
Yeah, and it was so touching when he realized that this band had perfected the Velvet Underground's arrangements, that he could just step in and sing with them. That's a beautiful thing.
And Václav Havel gave him, you know, a collection of his lyrics that was bound that people would pass around to, like, a kind of zamistad, you know, a kind of an underground text that they would share. And, you know, they gave it to Lou, and, like, you know, man, I mean, there's just nothing, I think, you know, better than that.
The other moment was that Lou did a signing for his book, and a bunch of people got to speak to him and tell him how much his lyrics had meant. And then, you know, he went backstage and he just began sobbing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Bill Bentley, who was his publicist and worked with him for many years, told me that story, and he said it was just incredible. You know, there was such a hard exterior, a hard shell that Lou had that he cultivated, you know. But in fact, you know, there was a tremendous insecurity, a tremendous sensitivity within him that would come through. Because I think ultimately Lou believed he was a writer. I think that was his main identity. And the fact that these people were coming to a bookstore for his words and telling them what those words meant, I don't think, you know, that was I think something that answered all of his ambitions.
And in the couple minutes we have left, I would say that, you know, in the final years of his life, the thing that allowed him to sort of have a final act and find some peace was Laurie Anderson.
Yeah.
And he everything was different with her, right?
Well, you know, it's really kind of a thing where, you know, he found, I think, someone who was able to get, you know, all of what Lou Reed was about, but yet had an independent life from him. And I think that was very important. You know, I think Lou tended to kind of, I think a lot of guys do this with women, you know, like where they, you know, they take the person in, they remold them, and then they get tired of them. Whereas that was not really possible with Laurie Anderson. And Lou, you know, people would ask me, what is it like being around Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson? I said, you know, and expecting, like, it's, you know, going to be some wild, crazy thing. I said, it's like being around, like, the high school quarterback and his cheerleader girlfriend. Like Lou was so deferential to her, like, I mean, pulling out her chair and, you know, this kind of thing. It was quite extraordinary.
So we've been talking to Anthony DeCurtis about his upcoming book, Lou Reed: A Life. It's out October 10th. It's a definitive and really deeply reported and, I would say, revelatory book about Lou Reed, and you come away knowing Lou, I think, better than ever. And I personally, mourning Lou is something I felt, and I'm sure you felt that a little bit,
so
writing it.
Deeply, yeah.
Anthony, I hope you'll come back sometime soon.
Brian, you know, just talking with you about music is always such a pleasure. Of course, anytime.
And so this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We're going to be back next week at 1 p.m. here on Volume, Sirius XM, Channel 106. And in the meantime, you can download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And you should definitely subscribe to us as a podcast as well. And maybe do us a favor and leave us a really nice review on iTunes. We'd appreciate it. But in the meantime, we will see you next week, and have a great weekend.